very much, Casey, and thanks for the invitation to speak here today. Thanks, Tom, for that introduction on biomonitoring. What I'm going to tell you about today is some of our work that's been funded by the US EPA to try and identify unique biomarkers of effective exposure to arsenic. This is an ongoing project which is trying to identify not only markers of exposure, but also to use the protein markers that we find to try and assess what types of phenotypes or health outcomes might be expected from those. So why arsenic? Well, first of all, arsenic is very widespread in the environment, and it's not really, the exposures are not really dependent upon dump sites, although they are very very prevalent in Superfund sites. It's more geologically based on whether or not you have exposures to arsenic or not. And you can be exposed in a couple of different manners through inhalation, but the predominant way of exposure to arsenic in the environment is through ingestion of arsenic, mostly through water ingestion. So arsenic is classified as a carcinogen, and that's based predominantly on epidemiological studies. And it targets mostly bladder, skin, and lung cancers for production. The EPA standards, which were dropped and in effect last year, dropped the standard from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion in U.S. water systems, is based mostly on bladder cancer data from a Taiwan study. But there are also other types of health effects that have been associated with exposures to arsenic in the water. You get the hyperkeratosis, and if you look on the left at the bottom of the feet there, you get this increased pigmentation that you see. It's been associated with the development of atherosclerosis, diabetes, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So as we said, the major route of exposure is through water ingestion. And the lung, though, is a target, whether or not it's inhaled or whether or not the arsenic exposure occurs through ingestion or through foods. And the predominant end organ effects in the lung are production of lung cancers. It also produces chronic bronchitis and bronchiectasis. So what we want to do is to examine chronic exposure to what we consider environmentally relevant doses of arsenic in drinking water. And I'll give you our experimental paradigm in just a minute. A lot of the data that's been done in animal research and in vitro research in the past has used very, very high doses in rodent model systems, and it's always questionable about how much those are actually modeling what's actually going on in humans. So we've chosen to use the levels of exposure that were the old standard at 50 parts per billion and the new standard at 10 parts per billion. So this is a USGS heat map of the levels of arsenic in public drinking water systems throughout the United States. And you can see that in the Southwest, I live in Arizona, you can see that our water systems have higher levels of arsenic. There's also levels in Maine, Minnesota, Michigan that also have high levels. Above the 50 micrograms per cubic liter or 50 parts per billion level. The other parts of the world which have probably at least 10 times this exposure, places like Bangladesh, places in South America, places in India, where it's a really, really severe health problem that has to be addressed. But this shows the heat map for the U.S. So our overall objectives in our studies are to look for modes and sites of action following our chronic exposure to our environmentally relevant doses, and then to develop a population of biomarkers of effect and exposure that can be used in human populations. So why proteins? Well, first of all, you could do a global study using gene expression analysis, but we felt that the protein is where the business end of what's actually going on in the organ, and so we wanted to look at protein biomarkers. This, though, presents some problems because of the large dynamic range of the amounts of proteins that you find in bodily fluids. And it's difficult then to see what you probably will be most interested in, which are the low abundance proteins. And so you have to do things like try to get rid of the more abundant proteins to screen for the lower abundant proteins or lower concentration proteins. Also, it's difficult to do these in humans, although people are doing that because of variability and the low abundance of the proteins. I'll show you our paradigm on the next slide where we've actually incorporated in vitro and in vivo model systems to help us predict what we might look for actually in humans and not to directly do the proteomics analysis in humans to start with. The second objective of our study was actually to measure the biomarkers in easily acceptable body fluids, and those can be defined as blood, urine, other body fluids. And the body fluid that we selected because we wanted it as much lung-specific as possible was actually induced sputum. So within the lung lining fluid, there are a number of proteins that are normally secreted into that that fluid. And if there's any cellular death or any kind of toxicological effects happening, there would be other proteins that could be secreted. In animal model systems, you can just put in saline and flush out those proteins and do an analysis. In humans, what you can have them do is inhale warm saline that causes them to cough, and you collect that induced sputum out, and you can measure the protein levels in human populations fairly non-invasively. So our model system is this. We have a mouse model system, which we give chronic ingestion to environmentally relevant doses of animals. And to look at mechanistic types of responses, we then combine that with an in vitro human cell line. And the cell line we use is an airway epithelial cell line to evaluate the mechanisms. Then we then use data from both of these systems to go into a human population studies to validate the protein alterations that we've seen in both our in vivo and in vitro systems. And in this case, we use ELISAs to specifically measure the protein concentrations in the induced sputum of the putative biomarkers that we found in our model systems. Here are my two colleagues that really helped tremendously with this, Jeff Burgess, who does the human population studies and what I'll show later, and Scott Boitano, who is working on the in vitro systems. So this is our animal model system. We have adult male mice that we expose to arsenic in the drinking water, 0, 10, and 50 parts per billion. The animals are exposed up to 8 weeks. We then have done a couple of different things. We've taken the whole lung and digested it, and we sent it off to Becton Dickinson, who had availability to run what are sort of power blots or multiple Western blots and give you quantitative information about 1,000 different proteins that they have within their database and look for changes in the whole lung. But then we've used the lung lining fluid, and we've done 2D gel electrophoresis to separate the proteins and look for different spots in the proteins, digest those proteins out, and use mass spec techniques then to identify what those proteins are. So sort of an unbiased way of doing that. We have other model systems, which I don't have time to talk about today, and that's looking specifically at airway epithelial cells by doing selective digestion and in our in vivo systems. And we also have ongoing studies that are funded by the NIH to look at the effects of arsenic in more susceptible populations. And the population we're looking at is during in utero and early postnatal development. So what about the whole lung digest that we saw and the proteins that resulted from this digestion? So the data here are from 50 part per billion for 8 week exposed mice. And this was run by the Becton Dickinson over 1,000 validated antibodies for their Westerns. And here are the list of proteins that were changed. And these were consistently changed in all exposed animals versus the controls. And there are a couple of different things that you can see in here. There's a number of proteins that actually are associated with cell motility, like RAC1 and Gelsolin. There are other proteins that are associated with apoptosis, like caspase-3, which is downregulated, meaning potentially that the cells are anti-apoptotic. If you take this data set and you run it in a curated database, which allows you then to look for either disease processes or cellular processes that might be defined by this set of proteins. And the database we used was GeneGo database. What you find is that these particular proteins describe the disease state of either cancer, which is what you would hopefully expect since arsenic is a carcinogen, and wound healing. And that the cellular processes that are most affected and described by this set of proteins is cell motility. I'll show data in just a minute that where we test this actually in our in vitro systems. So what about the lung lining fluid? That was whole lung extracts we just talked about. What about the lung lining fluid? So we do the 2D gel electrophoresis to separate out the proteins. It's separated based on molecular weight and isoelectric focusing. And what you do is you basically look for differences in spots across the gel. You can cut those out, digest them, run them on mass spec, and you can identify then the proteins. There's a separate analysis that we've also done called mud pit. In this case, you don't run the gels, you just run the proteins through a series of columns and digestions, and then you just take the columns, write off the columns into the mass spec for ID. So these are a series of proteins that have been validated, or at least have been identified in both of these systems. So the first one there is RAGE. It's called Receptor for Advanced Glycation End Products. It's a receptor that's responsible for looking at modified proteins and lipids. It produces an inflammatory response. It's also associated with wound healing, which is what we saw in our whole extracts, and in a protein that's associated with wound healing, matrix metalloproteinase 9 expression. There's an arsenic metabolizing enzyme that was altered, downregulated by our exposures. And there's also other enzyme systems, alpha-1 antitrypsin, which is associated with emphysema, apolipoproteins, which are downregulations associated with inductions of cancer. But we didn't only get downregulated, we also had some upregulated proteins. One is peroxyredoxin 6. This is a reductase that's found fairly highly expressed in the lung. It also has phospholipase activity. And so this, we think, is an indication that arsenic is producing some oxidative stress in the lung. And then enolase-1 was also upregulated, which is also an indicator of carcinogenesis. So if we take this data on our wound healing that we've seen both in our extracts and in our lung lining fluid, can we show that, in fact, that occurs in a model system in vitro? So what we've done here is these cells are human bronchial epithelial cells. They've been cultured for at least 24 hours in the presence of arsenic at 60 parts per billion. And then we introduce an artificial wound. We just scrape across the epithelial cells. And at time zero is the picture in the upper left. And in about 2 hours, what you see is that that, quote, wound starts to heal. The cells start to migrate back in towards each other to close it off. And after about a four-hour period, it's fairly closed, although there is still a little gap in this particular dose. What you can do is measure that gap as a function of arsenic concentration, and what you find is that there's a nice dose response, that the larger the arsenic concentration, the slower the healing of this particular wound that occurs. And so that this sort of supports our data, saying that the arsenic effects in vivo are affecting what's going on in this in vitro model, and they are affecting wound healing. We said that MMP9 might be altered as a function of the RAGE alteration and expression, and that's exactly what we see as well in our in vitro systems. So we see on the left upregulation of activity, that's a zymograph of activity of the enzyme, increased as a function of arsenic dose, and the protein levels on the right are also increased. We didn't see any effect, though, in another metalloproteinase 2 or in the inhibitor of these enzymes, TEMP1. So we've seen some alterations in our model systems, but the real question is, do these same types of changes occur in a human population exposed to arsenic? Well, this is a heat map of Arizona alone, showing the concentrations of arsenic in the water sources. And what we've done is Jeff Burgess then has going out to an old mining town. Tucson sits right here. An old mining town to the west of Tucson called Ajo. Some pictures of this mining town are here. Here's the old pit right here. There was also a smelter in this town where the arsenic in the drinking water is about 20 parts per billion. In Tucson, the levels are below 5 parts per billion. And we looked at a population here comparing it to Tucson, and we asked, well, are these proteins changed in this population like we saw in our model systems? And here's kind of the overall description of the populations. Right now we have 73 individuals about split evenly between the two sites. They're predominantly female, non-Hispanic whites. There really was no differences in a lot of their age, gender, race, asthma, and other incidences. We collected a first morning void of urine to measure the actual concentrations of arsenic in their urine. And we also measured tap water concentrations at the individual places. And we did ELISA, then protein measurements, to look for the three proteins I've listed below, MMP9, which we've seen altered, RAGE, and alpha-1 antitrypsin. So if you look at these, first of all, there's some interesting things. As we said, Tucson, the levels in Tucson water is about 5 parts per billion, and all the blue squares are those. But 5 parts per billion is here. And one of the things you'll note is that there are individuals living in Tucson supposedly only getting 5 parts per billion arsenic, which have significant levels of arsenic in their urine. Now, this could be due to either dietary effects, or maybe they have different water sources at their where they work, or we just don't know, but that there are differences that we do see. And so just relying on what was at the home tap water doesn't give you necessarily a good reflection of what the individual exposure of those people is. What you see here is this is the log ratio of the MMP9 to its inhibitor, TEMP1, as a function of the total urinary inorganic arsenic concentration. And as we saw in our animal models, there was an increase in this as a function of the arsenic exposure. So that correlates with what we saw in our model systems. Okay, this is RAGE in this particular graph. So this is the soluble RAGE on this, again, as a function of the arsenic. It was inhibited in our model systems, also inhibited here in the human populations. And this is alpha-1 antitrypsin, which was also downregulated, and we see the same type of thing down regulation as a function of increases in the urinary arsenic levels. So in our model systems, we predicted that these were the changes, and we've been able to validate that, in fact, in humans, we get similar types of changes to what we saw in our model systems. So the human data are consistent with the results from model systems. And so what we've been able to do, we think, to this point, is we've identified some unique protein biomarkers. The biomarkers we've identified were not associated with arsenic exposure and or effect prior to the research that we've been doing. These are associated with wound healing in cancers, and the in vivo and in vitro model systems used to predict what we would find in humans seems to be a successful strategy. So what about our future directions? Well, we want to continue in our in vitro systems to try and identify what the mechanisms are of this wound healing. And so we'll continue using confluence cultures and then producing scratches and other types of wounding to try and mimic the wound healing and see what happens. We have some preliminary data that suggests that calcium signaling is affected. In our in vivo model, we'll superimpose on top of just our regular exposures and a lung-specific epithelial damaging agent, which is naphthalene. Naphthalene will selectively kill some of the distal lung epithelial cells. It's been shown that combining this naphthalene treatment with cigarette smoke delays the ability or the time course of healing in the lung. And we feel that our data suggests that that would also be happening in our systems with arsenic. But what about the human populations? Well, if wound healing is actually occurring at these particular, or alteration in wound healing is occurring at these particular concentrations, you would predict that people which have the most lung injury, epithelial injury, would be the most sensitive to exposure to arsenic. And so we've hypothesized that people that already have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease from smoking, for example, have ongoing inflammation in the lung, have ongoing remodeling and repair in the lung, could be much more sensitive and have much more severe disease if they live in areas where they're ingesting high levels of arsenic. And we're in the process right now of trying to do a pilot study, recruiting individuals in Arizona that do have COPD and seeing whether their ingestion of arsenic is associated with more severe disease or not. And finally, these are the people who actually do the work. In addition to Scott and Jeff, B.J. Lynch did a lot, and George Saprielis, who runs our proteomics core, was invaluable. And of course, our funding sources and all of the work that I described today was funded primarily by U.S. EPA. And thank you. So we did control for the smoking and other the variables that were listed up there, certain disease states we looked at. And so, and what we were doing actually in those populations was just trying to validate what we saw in the model systems and asking the questions that in places where people have the higher arsenic levels, do these proteins change in the same way that they do in our model systems or not? And it appears that taking like smoking, weight, age, gender, all those other things into account, that yes, in fact, they do change in a similar fashion that we see in our model systems. Oh, I see. Yeah, that's I don't recall offhand. I'm sorry. I had to go back and look at the data. I'm not the person to ask. Probably Jeff Burgess would be the person to ask, since he's the one who does the human population analysis. Yes, Skip. So, non-activated and activated, like phosphorylated? Yes, we can in the proteomics analysis, but we have to sort of know what to look for ahead of time. And some of the proteins, like actually the enolase changed. We actually saw dual spots, for example, on the 2D gels. And if you go to the literature, there is an indication that enolase can be phosphorylated. So those changes look like it could be phosphorylated, but we can look for modifications. We can look for other modifications in addition to phosphorylation if the people in the proteomics core know what we want to look for.